Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us on this Thursday afternoon, at least where we are. Maybe it's Thursday evening or even Friday morning where you are. Wherever you are, we're glad you're here with us. If you've already celebrated it, excuse me for saying it, but it's still the feast day. So I will say a very happy and blessed feast of the Ascension of the Lord. And we're off today. And all of our questions come from the internet. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We always have fun doing this. Once we started doing weird questions, and that became a whole different thing we do, weird questions with Jimmy Akin. And so this is like normal. What do we call this? There's no music for this, Jimmy. Darren, there's no special music. We need some really normal music for normal questions for Jimmy Akin. One thing I really like about the internet open forums, though, is there are questions that we won't hear from a caller because the person needed to write it out, or because we get to kind of curate them a little bit. So I like these programs, and I hope you will as well for the next hour. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Thank you for coming back and being with us again, Jimmy Akin.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
When I mentioned it last hour, but I want to mention it again. Tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, we find out
a scientific experiment to weigh the soul, to find out how much the soul weighs.
Yeah.
And there have been some surprising results that came back from this experiment. So, it's been done a few times by different people, and one thing that's consistent about the results is they are surprising.
How interesting! So somehow you lose mass at the moment of death is what the
or gain it.
Oh, really? Oh, well, I'm definitely not dying then. I cannot. Yeah, I will not be able to fit into my pants at the funeral.
Yeah, well, it's a really weird situation. I actually talk in the episode. I know one of the people who's done a version of this experiment, and he got some surprising results, and I actually interview him in the show, and then I talk about, so what could explain the results that these different scientists got?
Oh, I can't wait to find out. It's just such a weird thing. It's weird that anybody even thought to do the experiment, but people think of clever things. And it's more than 100 years they've been doing this experiment now. As you said,
it was first done in like 1901.
All right. Here we go back to the internet for internet questions for Jimmy. This one comes from Suzanne, who asks, is Michael Heiser a heretic? Why are so many Protestants intrigued by his teachings?
Okay, so let's talk about who Michael Heiser was. He was an evangelical scholar, and I knew him. I knew Mike. Didn't agree with him on various things, but he was a good guy. He also just passed away. He died of cancer. He'd had it for a while, and I followed his journey and was praying for him and his family, and he only passed on very recently. And so I would encourage people to both pray for Mike's soul and to pray for the family that he left behind, because he died at a quite young age. So since he was an evangelical, he is Protestant, and that means that he disagrees with various aspects of the Catholic faith. But that doesn't make you a heretic. The term heresy, the way the church uses it, presupposes the fancy Latin term, the fancy legal term based on Latin roots, is contumacy, where you're basically, you know what you're doing is wrong and you just don't care. Okay, but that's not the situation Protestants are typically in. I mean, maybe some of them are, but others aren't. They were raised in the Protestant community. They sincerely believe Protestant teachings. They've never been Catholic. They've never been exposed to a good presentation of the Catholic faith. And so they're not contumacious. And as a result, they're not heretics. They may disagree on matters that could be heresy if one were contumacious about them, but they're not contumacious. And so the church refers to them as separated brethren, because they are our brothers in Christ by faith and by baptism. They unfortunately don't share the fullness of the Catholic faith, but they're still our brethren, and they are separated, but because they're not contumacious, they're not regarded as heretics. in terms of why are Mike's writings popular, well, he talked about interesting stuff. As I mentioned, he was a scholar, and he had an extensive background in ancient Near Eastern literature outside of the Bible. He also knew a lot about the Bible, but he also was aware of documents that are not part of the Bible that either were part of the Judeo-Christian tradition or outside of the Judeo-Christian tradition, like, you know, Mike spoke Ugaritic and, you know, the different Mesopotamian languages and things like that. And he had a broad reading in these areas that allowed him to engage on subjects that people find interesting, including obscure passages in the Bible, like what are the Nephilim that are mentioned in Genesis 6 and also in Numbers 11. Well, there are people in the UFO community who want to say that they're aliens. And Mike would, he'd get a little stern about it sometimes, but basically he would point out that that's not what the Nephilim are in the Bible. People would try to link them to the Anunnaki of Babylonian mythology. He would point out that the Anunnakim and the Nephilim are not the same thing, and that the Anunnaki are also not aliens. That is not what they are in Mesopotamian mythology. So he talked about UFOs. He talked about aliens. He talked about the Nephilim and the Anunnaki and other things that people find interesting. And he discussed biblical texts in light of surrounding literature that many people are completely unaware of. Like there's a Second Temple era document known as First Enoch, most of which was written, you know, 200 to 100 years before the time of Jesus. And so it was around in Jesus's day, and it was, First Enoch was even, is even quoted in the New Testament. It's quoted by the book of Jude. But almost nobody knows about it. No, almost nobody has read it. And there's some fascinating stuff in it, including stuff that deals with the Great Flood and the Nephilim. And Mike, being a scholar who researched this area, helped bring a lot of this to public attention. He also was responsible for publishing, for the first time in English, some of the scholarship that was originally written in other languages, like German. And he would get it in an English version and then publish it so people could be aware of it. He also did other things. One of his book is called, if I have the title exactly right, it's I Dare You to Bore Me with the Bible. And so he had an interesting take on things, and that's why people find his work interesting. Like I said, I don't agree with all of it. I think he was mistaken on some things, but he's got a lot of interesting things to think about, and some of the stuff he's talking about, I think he's right on.
Thank you so much, Suzanne, for the question. That brings us actually to the first break. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Marcus Grody and his son John Mark talk about the journey home.
How do I feel about passing the baton to my son? I am very excited about that.
It's weird to be stepping into my dad's role here. I'm humbled and honored, obviously, by the privilege and by his confidence in EWTN's and the audiences. In some sense, this is something I've been around all my life.
The journey continues on The Journey Home, Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and we've got a whole bunch of questions from the internet. It's an internet open forum. The internet has a lot of questions, mostly coming from people. Brian on the internet asks,
but you that, never know these days, because
no, it could be a machine.
On the internet, no one knows you're a dog.
That's right. Zach was trying to explain to me the other day something about some one of these chat GPT with some number had lied to somebody.
Oh, yeah. They will lie. They're not moral. They just shuffle symbols around. And sometimes what they shuffle them to say is false.
Those dirty chat GPTs. I did ask them, you know what? I had some ad copy that I didn't like, and I sent it to Zach, and I said, because Zach's best friend is ChatGPT. He loves ChatGPT more than any living human. I said, can you ask your best friend to rewrite this ad copy for me? And it did a pretty good job. It made a nice ad out of it. It was very enthusiastic, though, like ridiculously enthusiastic. I had to tone that down a little bit. It appears to think that you're just supposed to go completely over the top. Yeah. But it was interesting to see what it did. Brian wants to know this. This question has always been on my mind. The Bible periodically speaks of God as being the one true God, or mentions, as I paraphrase, no other gods are like our God. What's the faith teach about other gods? Are the Hindu, Buddhist, Greek, Roman, Mayan, etc. gods real to an extent? I always wondered if they could have been demons or fallen angels manipulating things on earth. Would love to explore that topic of other gods and their legitimacy.
Okay, so it's interesting that this question is, I don't recall if I placed it deliberately this way, but it's interesting we're dealing with it right after the Michael Heiser question, because this is one of the subjects that Mike wrote about. He has several books exploring this question. One of them is called Reversing Herman, but he also discusses elements of this in his book Demons, and he may talk about it some in his book Angels. But he's got several books that interact in this area. Probably Reversing Herman is the one I would recommend starting with. So the Magisterium does not have a teaching on the status of pagan deities. There's no papal encyclical, or you can't find it in the catechism where it will say, here is the ontological status of pagan deities and what they are. So this is not a matter of church teaching. But and because of that, it's in the realm of opinion. People can have different opinions about this. You could say that pagan gods simply don't exist. That if you're praying to Zeus, nobody's listening to the phone because the phone is not even hooked up. And your prayers are just going off into a void. On the other hand, you could say, no, I think there is someone that does correspond to Zeus. And so if you talk to that person and the person has sufficient awareness, then they would know you're talking to them. And such a being would transcend human ability, you know, because we're not able to tell if someone in the remote part of the world suddenly talks to Jimmy Akin. Well, unless there's an internet connection, I don't know about it. So simply being able to talk and have someone hear you, that would be beyond human ability, at least under ordinary circumstances. And so if no human has that ability, well, an angel might, an angelic being. So you could propose maybe there are angels who are the gods of these nations, except the gods of these nations want to be worshipped. At least their followers were under the impression that they do. They, in fact, were afraid if we don't worship them, they're going to smite us. And so we know that we should only worship God. We shouldn't worship anyone other than God. And so if there are angels that want us to worship them as Zeus or Hera or Thor, then that would be bad. Mm-hmm. These would be bad angels, and so they would be what could be called demons. And that's a common view. The view or a version of it appears actually in the Old Testament. If you look in Deuteronomy, it says that when God proportioned out the nations, he did so according to the number of the sons of God. And sons of God is a phrase that's used in the Old Testament for high-ranking angels. And so the basic idea is God portioned out the nations and put them under the care of individual high-ranking angels. But Israel, God kept for himself. So Israel is God's portion. It's God's inheritance. But these other nations are under the charge of angels. And some of the angels went bad. And we see that in the book of Daniel, because in Daniel, Daniel's doing some fasting at one point, and the angel Gabriel shows up 3 weeks later and says, "Hi, sorry I'm late, but in getting here, the prince or commander," the word in Hebrew is, or Aramaic is, sar, and it means prince or commander. So he's referring to the angel who's in charge. He says, "The prince of Persia," meaning the angelic prince who's in charge of Persia, "detained me." So Gabriel was on his way to respond to Daniel's prayer, but the angelic prince of Persia blocked him. And he's been dealing with the prince of Persia for 3 weeks. That's why he's late. And he says, "Actually, I couldn't get past the prince of Persia until Michael, the prince of your people, Israel." So Michael is working for God to oversee Israel. "Michael came to my aid," and he's basically got the prince of Persia in an angelic headlock right now. "And that let me come through the lines to give you this message. So here's the message. And now I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go help Michael deal with the prince of Persia, and we're going to stomp him. And after we get done stomping him, that's going to create a power vacuum, and the prince of Greece is going to arise." And the prince of Greece would be the angelic prince in charge of the Greek people. And the historical manifestation of this was a shift in power between the Persian Empire and the Empire of Alexander the Great. What Gabriel is doing is giving us what's happening behind the scenes in the angelic world. As the Persian Empire is falling, the prince of Persia is being defeated by Gabriel and Michael. That creates a power vacuum that the prince of Greece then moves into, and the Greek Empire starts to take control on Earth. So, since we have bad guy angels like the prince of Persia, who is opposing Gabriel and Michael, who are working for God, that would suggest that these angelic princes, at least some of them, went bad. And that was a common understanding in the Old Testament period of who the gods of the nations were. It's also alluded to in the New Testament, and you'll find the church fathers basically endorsing the same view. But it is a matter of opinion. It is not a matter of church teaching. If you'd like more information about this, I actually did an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on this topic. You know, what is the status of non-Christian gods? Are they at all real or not? What are they? It's episode 112. So if you go to mysterious.fm/112, you'll find this episode. You could also Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, episode 112, or Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, God and the Gods. That's the title of the episode.
Brian, thank you so much for the question. Very, very fine question. Our next question, our open forum is an internet open forum today. Jimmy Akin, of course, our guest. Teresa asks this: "I learned from a Catholic trivia game that as a result of the 1917 Code of Canon Law, the moon is considered part of the Diocese of Orlando, Florida. There was no citation, however. What is the law in question, and how does it apply to the moon when it was promulgated before space exploration began?"
Well, as Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. Don't just take someone's word on something. Look up the citation, and don't believe everything you read in a Catholic trivia game. There is a basis to this story, but it's not apparently what the trivia game said. So here's the scoop. The Diocese of Orlando, Florida, contains Brevard County. And Brevard County contains Cape Canaveral. And Cape Canaveral is where the Apollo missions were launched from. So in the 1960s or 70s, after the moonshots, you know, bishops have the, I don't know if you've heard of them, Sykellet, but bishops have these things called, what are they called? Ad limina visits.
Oh, yes, I have heard of those. Yeah. Yes. Imagine and if you were like out in space as the bishop of a space diocese and you had to make your ad limina.
Exactly. And so they have these ad limina visits they have to make to Rome every few years to meet with the Pope. And so after the moonshots, the bishop of the Diocese of Orlando, William Borders, was on a visit to Rome, and he was meeting with the Pope, and he mentioned that he happened to have the largest diocese in the universe because the moon is part of it. And this came as a great surprise to His Holiness Paul VI. He had not been aware of this, and according to the story, he asked this to be checked into. Well, the trivia game that Teresa encountered apparently said that this is due to the 1917 Code of Canon Law, and that is not the case. I checked the 1917 Code of Canon Law, and it doesn't appear, I could have missed it, I don't think I did, but it doesn't appear that the 1917 Code of Canon Law, which was in force in the 1960s and 70s, that it has any provision related to this. But there is an earlier principle from the age of exploration, when Europeans were, you know, getting on sailing ships and exploring parts of the world that had never been discovered before and bringing missionaries there, setting colonies there. Well, those need to be under some Catholic bishop, and there ain't no Catholic bishop over there yet. So what they would do is they would assign newly discovered territories, newly visited territories in the age of exploration, to the diocese of wherever the expedition left from. So if, let's say, you're on a ship, your expedition leaves from Lisbon, Portugal, and discovers some new island, okay, that new island is now going to be, and all the Catholics there are for the moment going to be responsible to the Bishop of Lisbon. And so this was not in the 1917 Code of Canon Law, but apparently part of older supporting legislation from the age of exploration. However, and on that basis, the Bishop of Orlando could say, hey, even if he was joking, he could say, hey, I got the largest diocese in the universe because the Apollo expeditions left from here and went to the moon. So the moon is my territory. Well, that's probably not true today. For one reason, the 1917 Code of Canon Law is not in effect anymore, but even more fundamentally, there are two legal concepts that were brought to bear, or that need to be brought to bear here. The first is a concept called desuetude. Desuetude means a law loses its force if it is not enforced for an extended period of time. If the law falls into disuse, which is what desuetude means, it means disuse. If it falls into disuse, it's no longer a law. And we haven't been discovering new territories and assigning them to bishops for a long time. The whole world is already pretty well mapped. And so that law has probably fallen into desuetude. Even if it hadn't, the law has been fundamentally, the technical term is integrally reordered. That means completely reordered, or sort of reordered from the ground up. First in 1917, when it was first codified, that was the first time that canon law was put in a single code. And then again in 1983, when the 1917 code was retired and replaced by the 1983 code. So between desuetude and the change, the fundamental reorganization of the law, that law doesn't seem to be repeated in current law, and therefore it does not appear to me that there is a strong case that the moon is part of the Diocese of Orlando. However, this will keep coming up in the future, because we're going back to the moon. We're going to have stations there. Those are little colonies, and there are going to be some Catholics in those colonies, and they're going to need to report for practical purposes to some diocese. And eventually there will be priests on the moon, and assuming our Lord tarries, you know, doesn't come back immediately, there will eventually be priests on the moon. There will eventually be, if the human population grows big enough, a bishop on the moon. We're also going to Mars. There will be Catholics on Mars. There will be priests on Mars. One day there could be a bishop on Mars. And in that day, he may have to make his ad limina visit back to Rome every so often.
Just in case anybody doesn't know, I wrote a little novella called Ad Limina, which is about a bishop in the future who lives on Mars, has to make his ad limina to Rome. And as you can imagine, it's difficult to get from the moon to Rome, even in the future. I mean, not Mars the moon, from Rome. Mars to Rome, even in the future. So Although I'd rather be the Bishop of Mars than the Moon, I just feel like more gravity better. The low gravity on the Moon, I don't know, makes me nervous. I feel like I'd like to have a little more gravity than that. And you would think I'd be the kind of person that would like less gravity. Doesn't that seem like
Well, if you're a real gravity fan, you should try, you know, Jupiter.
No way. No way. Does Jupiter even have a rocky core?
No, but actually, yes, but the gravity will crush you before you get down to it.
Well, thanks for the invitation to go there, Jimmy. All right, we'll take a quick break. Right back with more Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes, best-selling author Rod Bennett gives a riveting re-examination of gospel events from the ground floor perspective of Christ's own hand-picked successors. In his trademark storytelling style, Bennett movingly depicts what it was like for the apostles to witness Jesus' teaching and miracles up close. Why did he call them, and what did he intend for them to do? Order your copy of These 12 today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
I didn't even know we were going to get groovy music today, Darren. Thanks. A little bit of groovy music there for the Feast of the Ascension of the Lord. All kinds of great questions from the internet because it's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin's here. Try to beat that for a Thursday afternoon. This one comes from Luis in Arizona. I love my wife, my cats, my country, and cheesecake. Why then do I find it so hard to believe that I love the Lord? Considering all that the Lord has done, I feel I should be positively burning with love and gratitude and that I should actively live each moment of my life in His service. Yet I get caught up in life. I sin, and that burning devotion never really materializes. I am left feeling selfish and ungrateful. I pray, I try to keep the commandments, and I avail myself of the sacraments, but if you ask, do you love the Lord? I will hesitate. If I really did love Him, I'd be a better person, less of a sinner, and my love for Him would burn far greater than my fear of His judgment, right? I certainly have fear of the Lord. My greatest longing is to be numbered among His sheep. My greatest terror is to be cast out with the goats, even though I deserve it. Is this just scrupulosity? Am I being too hard on myself? Can love and fear of the Lord be the same thing? Am I missing something important that I need to change?
So let me answer this question by asking you a question, Cy Kellett.
Okay.
Let's suppose, now you're a father.
Yeah.
So let's mentally travel back in time to when, let's say, your eldest son was 5 years old.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
And one day you are out on a walk in the park with your son, and he runs off and falls in a river that's going through the park. So, and he's 5 years old. He does not know how to swim.
Okay.
So he's fallen into this river and is in danger from the current and the rocks, and he doesn't know how to swim, so he's in danger of drowning. He's in a troublesome situation. So you, being a good father, dive into the water to save him. As you are diving into the water to save your son from dying in front of you, how do you feel? What's your emotion? What's the feeling that's uppermost in your mind at the moment?
A terror that he won't make it, that I won't get to him, that something, yeah.
Right. Now, let's look at this from another perspective.
Okay, yeah.
Objectively, are you doing something loving for your son?
Yes, right.
I would say you're doing something extremely loving for your son. You're putting yourself at risk to save him. So what this shows us is feelings and acts of love are not the same thing. You can be feeling one way, like terrified, and you're actually doing something very loving at the same moment. So we are not called to have certain feelings about God. If we get feelings, that's good. And it's normal that at least at points in our lives, we will have feelings. But that's not what we're called to do. We're called to actively love God, meaning make him our first priority. And you know, not be willing to do things that would utterly contradict his will. So there's also a second lesson to learn from the Raging River example, though. So I want to loop back to learn the second lesson, and I'll illustrate it with another question for Psychelet.
Okay.
So you've said you feel terror in the moment you're diving into the river.
Yeah.
But you're objectively doing an act of love for your son.
Right.
Why do you feel terror?
Because I love him.
Because you love your son. Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, these negative emotions like terror can reveal underlying love. And it's only because if you didn't love your son, if it was just, you know, and if it wasn't your son, if it was a gum wrapper,
yeah,
you wouldn't even bother diving in to save the gum wrapper, much less be terrified that the gum wrapper might go to the bottom of the river.
Right.
It's because you love your son that generates the terror. And so if Luis finds himself terrified of the idea of being separated from God, what does that mean about Luis's feelings for God? He ultimately must love God, or he wouldn't care about being separated from him. It's like in a romantic relationship. If you're terrified you're going to lose your wife or lose your girlfriend, it's because you love her. And in the same way, if you're terrified of being separated from God, okay, well, that's your current momentary feeling. But what it reveals is you actually love God. So, yes, this is scrupulosity. You don't need to worry about this, Luis. You actually love God. And feelings are not under our direct control. They come and go, and we shouldn't use them as a marker of are we right with God or not. If God is your ultimate priority, you want to be with him, then you may have sin in your life. We all have venial sin at least. But if your will is fixed on God as the ultimate good, you do love him. You love him above all things, whether you realize it or not. So realize the fact you love him and put aside the fear.
Luis, thank you so much for such a great, great question. I appreciate that very much. It's an internet open forum. That's why I'm reading the questions. And the next one comes from Bennett. Bennett asks, if, as written, a wife needs to submit to her husband and a husband should love his wife like Christ loves the church, how does this make sense if the wife must, in some relationships, make a better leader? Is it really the teaching that a family may suffer if absolutely the inadequate person is the leader? Is it church teaching that a woman cannot be a better head than any man?
Psychelet, is it a teaching of the church that every man is a better leader than every woman?
It is not.
Teaching? No, it's not. Now, St. Paul does talk about this principle, but let's think for a minute about what St. Paul was aware of. St. Paul was aware that a lot of the women in his audience were converted, and they were already married. You know, they were converted to the Christian faith. They were already married, and their husband didn't necessarily convert with them. So he knows that a lot of his audience has a mixed marriage situation. Technically, the term would be disparity of cult, but they're married to non-Christians. So would St. Paul say to the women in his audience that are married to non-Christians, you know, let's say they're married to a worshiper of Jupiter and Mars.
Right.
Would St. Paul say to these women, guess what? This guy who worships Jupiter and Mars, he's your spiritual leader.
No, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Doesn't make any sense at all. Also, St. Paul knew of other situations, like let's say a particular husband is a raging alcoholic, which did exist in the ancient world, and is utterly incapable of managing family finances. You know, if you let him, he's going to spend it all on drink if you let him. Okay, so would St. Paul say, I'm sorry, he's your household leader, so it is wrong of you, Mrs. Dosithius, to take over management duties from your husband, even though he's completely irresponsible and blitzed out of his mind. You've got to let him make all the decisions for you and your kids. Would St. Paul say that?
No, of course not. No, he's so practical, St. Paul. No.
Yeah. So St. Paul recognizes there are situations in which a man is not the competent leader. And if a man is competent and realizes his wife is more talented than him in some area, he's going to use that resource. He's not going to be threatened and say, oh, I must assert myself in our family. If he realizes his wife is better at bookkeeping than he is, which is the case in a lot of families, he'll let the wife do the bookkeeping. Or if he recognizes she's the better negotiator and they have a pressing negotiation, like maybe to buy a house or something, he'll let her take the lead on the negotiation.
Yeah.
That's just smart to let this more skilled person apply their skills for the benefit of the family. And so even though there is a general principle, which is rooted in the nature of males, that they tend to have a leadership drive and desire that's greater than the comparable one in women, at least statistically it's greater on average. Even though men do have a leadership drive and capacity that is frequently of benefit to the family, especially in dangerous situations, because men are built to physically and psychologically to be protectors. There's a general principle here, but this is not an absolute that is exceptionless. I mean, you can just imagine, let's suppose we've got a wife married to a husband and the husband is quadriplegic. Someone breaks into the house. Who has the responsibility to defend whom against the home invader?
Right.
Is the quadriplegic husband responsible for saving his wife, or is she responsible for saving him? Well, in this situation, in an ordinary situation, if he wasn't quadriplegic, the husband would need to defend the wife, or better, they could both team up. But if one has to defend the other, it would be the husband. But since he's quadriplegic, obviously the wife is the one who's going to need to engage the home invader. So we shouldn't think of this principle that Paul is articulating as an exceptionalist norm. I happen to have written about this before, and we'll try to have in the description of the video a link, or in the show notes, a link to an article I wrote that's at Catholic.com. It's called Spiritual Headship. And you can also get to it by just Googling my name, Jimmy Akin, and the words spiritual headship.
Thank you, Jimmy. You have that, Darren, that will be in the show notes here at Catholic Answers. And that brings us to a break, actually. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And I have to say, this 2 hours has gone very quickly. I think I really enjoy Internet Open Forum. So many interesting questions. Jimmy, of course, is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You can find it at mysterious.fm, mysterious.fm, or just put in the words Jimmy Akin Mysterious World in whatever search bar you use, and it'll get you there. It'll get you there because it's very popular, and when you get there, you'll see why. It's just a really fun opportunity to look into various mysteries and conspiracies and strangeness of all kinds from a very reasonable and also a very faithful perspective. So mysterious.fm, check it out. This next question for Jimmy comes from Mark. Can saints and demons, for that matter, hear our thoughts? If not, is silent prayer to saints therefore useless?
Okay, so let's reason our way through this backwards. The church teaches that praying to the saints is a good thing to do, asking the saints in heaven to intercede for us. The church technically doesn't use the language prayer to the saints. That's just kind of what people say colloquially. What the church says is asking for their intercession. So that's the essence of what we're doing. We're asking them to intercede or pray for us. So they're our heavenly prayer partners. And the church teaches this is not useless, in part because the Bible shows the saints in heaven, including angelic saints, actually interceding for us and offering the prayers of the saints on earth to God. So so we know it's not fruitless, and there's no restriction here about, oh, you've got to say it out loud. I mean, why would us saying it out loud make any difference? Because a saint in heaven ain't got ears. They don't have their body right now, and they don't even have ears that are close by me. So if I use my voice to move some air molecules around and say, St. Barbara, pray for me, how's St. Barbara going to hear that if she doesn't have ears? Well, since she doesn't have ears, she's not going to hear it physically. She's not in the room with me listening to the vibrations of the air with physical ears that she doesn't have. So she must, because since St. Barbara doesn't have a body right now, she's the mind. She's an intellect. So she must be learning about my prayer mentally somehow. And the question is then, how? Well, the church doesn't have a teaching on that. It does teach that the saints, you know, will know about our prayers and be able to pray for us, at least in some way, but it doesn't say how. And so theologians have speculated about this. One obvious speculation that people today would have is, okay, mind-to-mind contact, or what today would be called telepathy. I mean, we've got a mind, they got a mind. They don't have a body, but they can hear what I'm doing. So telepathy would be one possibility. But it's not the only possibility. In the Middle Ages, you know, theologians actually debated this question and the question of angelic intellects too, because what they would do is they would think about angels as a way of thinking about human abilities, because angels are pure intellects. They're pure spirits. Humans are mixed, both spirit and body. So if you can figure out what an angel can do without a body, that tells you something about what a human spirit could do, including when it's out of the body, like in the intermediate state between death and resurrection. So medieval theologians would use angels as a model for human spirits to figure out, okay, well, if an angel can do this, then it should be possible in principle for a human to do it too. But different theologians had different opinions about exactly what angels could do and exactly what humans could do. Aquinas, and I'll mention him because he's the most prominent theologian, but by no means the only one, his opinion, not everybody's opinion, but his opinion was that humans need their physical senses in order to gain data. So once they're out of the body, they don't really have a way to sense the world. And they need to learn about the world through some other means. Basically, these aren't the terms that Aquinas used, because the term telepathy hadn't been coined yet, nor had the term download. But God downloads information that a saint needs telepathically. So God's kind of like a giant internet hub and who's omniscient and knows everything. And so if you're praying to a saint, God knows about your prayer and will download that information to the saint because it's relevant to him. He would want to know, as a loving person, he would want to know that someone wants his prayers. So God makes that information accessible directly. But there are other possibilities. Like I said, saints could be telepathic. What we do know is that prayer to the saints, including silent prayer, is not useless. So, what about demons? Because that was part of the question too. Well, if you ask various, again, there's no church teaching on this. This is purely a matter of theological opinion. And I have heard people just confidently say, demons can't read your mind. Period. Okay, how do you know that? I mean, they're pure intellects. They can talk to each other, like when the Prince of Persia is fighting with Gabriel and Michael. I'm sure they're having conversations, you know. So how do you know that they're not telepathic? It would seem, if they have exchange of information between angels, unless they're using God as an internet router, between angels and demons, they're talking in some kind of language, mental language to each other. You could call it mentalese. St. Paul, and this is, could be a metaphor, but he at least refers to the tongues of angels, to the languages of angels. And that would suggest direct angel to angel or angel to demon communication. And it would have to be mental communication, so it would look like telepathy. At least that would be the most logical guess at first glance. So if angels are telepathic, then demons would be telepathic, and how do you know they can't read your mind? Now, there was an opinion among some medieval theologians, like Aquinas, who would say, okay, they're telepathic, but it's not involuntary telepathy. So you can't read, an angel cannot read another angel's mind against his will. In order for one angel to read another angel's mind, he has to do the equivalent of talk. He has to disclose his thoughts. And so angels can disclose their thoughts to other angels who can then read them. Just like if Psy opens his mouth and says something, I can hear and understand him. So that's a possibility. But I wouldn't count on it. It's an interesting possibility. I wouldn't consider it proved, though, because it's just an assertion that they have involuntary telepathy. Maybe they're utterly transparent to each other. Maybe they have full telepathic penetration. And so one angel, as soon as he thinks about another angel, knows everything that other angel is thinking. You know, that could happen too. So I don't think we have an answer on this question, but let's go with the voluntary telepathy model. What would an angel looking at a human be able to do? Well, presumably angels, I mean, they can interact with the world. They can interact with people. They can even assume temporary bodies. So they can obviously, they're aware of us and our bodies. I don't, you could debate how they're aware, but they are aware of us. And so, Psychelet, if you saw me rolling my eyes and smacking my forehead, what kind of mood do you think I would be in?
Annoyed. Annoyed.
Annoyed, frustrated, exasperated, yeah. Something like that. So you can learn something about my mental state by watching my body language.
Yeah.
Because you're smart, sure. You're a human, and we watch each other's body language to learn what the other person is thinking. We're great mind readers, at least indirectly. Okay, so if you can learn that, and if angels are much, much smarter than us, you think an angel could learn a lot about my mental state by watching my body language?
Yeah, right, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
They can, even if they can't directly read our minds, they are able to figure out a lot about what we're thinking by observing our external behavior. But why should they be limited to our external behavior? We have angels in the Bible manipulating microbes, you know, like when God sends a plague. Okay, and he has an angel deliver it. Okay, that angel is administering the behavior of microbes.
Right.
So they would seem to have remarkable information access to what's happening in the world. I don't see a way to limit that. You know, I can't draw a line and say, oh, but angels can't perceive things beyond this point. Well, okay, but if they can perceive really small things like microbes, they could probably perceive what the neurons in our brains are doing, because the neurons in our brains send out electrical impulses. They run electrochemically and they generate magnetic fields. And we can even sense those with the right equipment. And so if we can sense them, then angels probably can too. And if angels can sense what the neurons in your brain are doing, and if the neurons in your brain reflect what you're thinking, then angels can probably tell what you're thinking. Even if they can't read your intellect directly, they can read what your brain is doing. And so can we. We already have the beginnings of what is called mechanical telepathy, where you put someone in a brain scanner, and based on looking at what their brain is doing, you can figure out what they're thinking. We even have people who are like paralyzed who can play games. Now, they can play video games because the brain scanner that they're using can tell what they want the characters in the game to do. You know, turn left, turn right, hit, attack, whatever. They can play video games because the machine is reading their mind, or at least their brain states. Wow. And so if we can read brain states and have mechanical telepathy, angels can too. So I am not at all confident. I understand why people say it, that, oh, don't worry, demons can't read your mind. Well, even if they can't do it directly, they can probably do it through indirectly. I understand why you'd say something like that to someone, because they won't worry, but I don't think it's true. I think the real solution to worry here is don't care about it. Trust yeah. God. He loves you. He's protecting you. Don't worry about anything else.
Amen to that, Jimmy. Jimmy Akin, thanks so much. What a wonderful 2 hours. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, and happy Ascension Thursday or Sunday, everybody.
Yeah, exactly, depending on how it's celebrated where you are. That does it for us. If you think, I got internet questions, I'd like to get to them, you can send them to radio@catholic.com or use one of the various other ways of communicating with us that you can find out there on the internet. We'll do our best to get you an answer. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.